Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, my notes tell me that we have the students from Port Washington High School with us this morning. If they're present, would they please stand? Oh, my, a wonderful group. You may be seated. The students are here on a program we operate in coordination with the State Bar called Court with Class, so they've had some opportunity to hear about the case that you're going to argue today. If you can remain after our second argument, I will come down and chat with you a little bit about the Supreme Court, how cases get here, what you can expect from the court in regard to the case that you've just heard, not in regard to the substance, but that the court will discuss it and make a decision and how we go about doing that. So if you can remain, that would be great. All right. And so I will then call our first case, State versus A.L. Counsel, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, ma'am.
Please do.
Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Jorge Fragoso. It's my pleasure to represent A.L. in court this morning.
At the outset, counsel, I'm going to ask that you make sure that you speak up for, not for me, but for the rest of my colleagues who might have trouble hearing you.
That would be me.
Thank you. Thank you for hearing this important case. This deals with a vulnerable population, that is primarily developmentally delayed juveniles. I ask the court to take this case in order to decide whether the juvenile competency statute, that's Wisconsin statute 938.30 sub 5, allows the circuit court, in its capacity as a juvenile court, to reinstate delinquency proceedings against a juvenile who's been found incompetent and not likely to become competent within the statutory time limits. I hope to discuss a few important points. Number one, Wisconsin Statute 938.30 sub 5 is not ambiguous. It contains all of the instructions that a circuit court needs to evaluate the competency of a juvenile and to meet the objectives of the juvenile court in an expeditious manner. If a juvenile is incompetent, the delinquency petition must be suspended. The petitions of all incompetent juveniles are suspended. The court must order one of the following. If the court believes that if there's probable cause, the court should petition for or order the state to petition for detention under Chapter 51. Otherwise, the court should order the state to petition under Section 938.13 sub 4, which is commonly known as a JIPS order. If the juvenile is likely to gain competency within the relevant time limits, then the case remains suspended while the juvenile's competency is restored, and the juvenile is reexamined according to the statute, which is about every 3 months and within 30 days of release. If reexamination reveals that the juvenile is competent, then the court shall schedule a hearing, and if the court decides the juvenile is competent, then the juvenile shall terminate. The court shall terminate the juvenile's commitment or disposition order first, and then resume the delinquency proceeding. Secondly, JIPS is a dispositional order. The disposition of JIPS is controlled by Wisconsin Statute 938.345. It says that the court shall enter one of the dispositions under Section 938.34, which is the long statute that controls dispositions generally ordered by the juvenile court under a care and treatment plan. It does have some exceptions. It doesn't allow for some forms of custody as part of the disposition in JIPS, but it does allow that primarily as a sanction for violating one of the conditions of the JIPS orders. A JIPS order must contain a statement of conditions which the juvenile is required to comply under. In that way, the JIPS order provides accountability. So it provides treatment for the incompetent juvenile, and it also provides accountability. I'd also like to discuss the fact that this is not an easy problem to solve, that there is a correlation between incompetence and age, that a fair amount of juveniles are found incompetent and subsequently found competent. And that's in part why the statute has a provision for evaluating whether the juvenile is going to be found competent or is likely to be found competent within the time limits. One more thing I want to address, just because it seems very hard to escape, and I see it in the Court of Appeals opinion. The term regain is often used in terms of competency, but when we're dealing with juveniles and when we're talking about the fact that a lot of times these kids are incompetent because of their age, there's not a regaining competence. It's simply a gaining competence. So some of the juveniles that would fall into those likely to regain or to gain competency during the time limits are probably the ones that might require medication or being removed from some situation. And that's primarily who gets addressed there. The trial court in this case denied the state's motion to bring back the case, to reassess competency. And the court gave three reasons that the trial court, so again, this is, I think, important because it's from the trial court's practical perspective. Three reasons why the legislature may have written the law the way that it wrote it.
Counsel, before you get to that, perhaps you could help me frame this a little bit better. And let's start with your reply brief at page 13, where you say the court cannot reinstate the competency proceedings of a juvenile who was initially found not likely to become competent within the statutory time limits because the mechanism actually created following Judge Flanagan's letter is one that prioritizes the effort to keep incompetent juveniles from, quote, falling through the cracks of the system, even if it means giving up on their prosecution. What do you mean by falling through the cracks?
Well, Your Honor, I was quoting directly there. I want to be clear here that because my position is that the statute is not ambiguous, I don't believe that this court should turn to or rely upon legislative history. I was addressing legislative history in my reply brief, however, and the term falling through the cracks specifically came from Judge Flanagan's letter, the inception of the change in the incompetency statute dates back to 1993. There is a document in the legislative record that shows that Judge Flanagan reached out to the legislature and said, right now we have a mechanism for NGI, children who are found not guilty for reason of insanity or mental defect. There was a provision to put them into a JIPS order simply based on that finding. And so what the judge was asking for was a similar mechanism for children who are found incompetent during delinquency proceedings. And what the court saw was an urgent need to address the needs of these kids and keep them from potentially reoffending. So
right. So now we're faced with a circumstance where the juvenile is not really a juvenile anymore. So if I understand your position correctly, you are advocating that nothing can be done with respect to this individual in the criminal justice system, correct?
Nothing additional can be done. He was under a JIPS order and subject to JIPS accountability for a period of 2 years, and then the JIPS order was not renewed.
Right. But the proceedings could not move forward because he was found not competent, right?
That's right. The delinquency proceedings.
All right. So nothing has happened on the delinquency proceeding, correct? Because he's been found non-competent.
That's right.
All right. And your position is that because he successfully reached the age of 18 before being found competent, that he should escape any consequences that were covered by the delinquency proceedings?
Well, a few things. He's not escaping consequences covered by the delinquency proceedings because he wouldn't be under the JIPS order if not for the delinquency petition. Secondly, I don't see it as escaping or successfully making it to 18 before finding competence, I don't think that anybody would choose to remain incompetent for any period.
Not a question of choosing to remain non-competent. The question is, I mean, presumably at least, if the delinquency proceeding had progressed to its natural conclusion, if he was competent, there would have been consequences if he had been found delinquent, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So because that did not happen, those consequences have not happened.
Well, those consequences are controlled by Wisconsin Statute 938.34.
Right. Before you get there,
okay.
Do you agree that those consequences have not occurred?
Well, if the consequences were secure custody or one of the other dispositions that is not available to a GIPS order, then yes, we don't know what those consequences would be. But every other consequence is available to the GIPS order.
Okay, so now we have, he reaches the age of majority, and because he had not regained competence before that time, is it your position that acts as a sort of a double jeopardy bar against proceeding against him?
The sort of trade-off that I think happens is that once a juvenile is found incompetent, there's a time period during which competency can attempt to be restored. And that needs to be justified under Jackson v. Indiana, right? Any kind of imposition in Jackson v. Indiana is specifically addressing custody. But the imposition that's put in place against the person has to be justified by a move toward competence.
Isn't it significant that that was a case involving custody? And all the cases that you cite involve the inability to hold someone indefinitely in custody while you're determining competency, right? That's not what we have here.
Right. No, that's true. And I think that it's significant to the extent that clearly being in custody, you know, without limits is very different than being under a GIPS order.
Or even not being under a GIPS order, right? The GIPS order expired. So you're really just talking about, you're saying this is, you're arguing to us that this is not ambiguous. So
right.
If that's the case, we look just at the statute. We don't look at legislative history. The statute says suspend.
Yes.
Suspend means it could be reopened. It's not dismissed. It's not discharged. The legislature knows how to use those words and chose not to. So if that's your argument, how do you get around the word suspend?
Well, the word suspend means the same thing, essentially, as the word stay. And when somebody's placed on probation, their sentence is stayed. And the probation statute does not ever say that the court has to go back and, you know, disappear the sentence or quash the sentence or anything. It's just stayed, and eventually the probation ends and
or
the sentence
can be reopened by the court.
I'm sorry?
That's a good analogy. So if I'm a court, which I've done before, and I stay probation
right.
or stay a sentence, I can reopen that, correct?
You cannot reopen that?
No, I said I can. The
during
court
the
can.
During the period of probation.
Correct.
Right.
So I stay jail time, and then it could be imposed.
Right, during the period of probation.
Right, but this is during the pendency of this. I mean, what's, you're saying you're
well, okay,
putting
so,
a time limit on this, and where is the time limit in the statute?
Right, so I think that what we're missing is a step here. Paragraph
we're missing
five,
a what? A step?
Missing a step here. Paragraph 5D says suspend. Paragraph 5D and paragraph 5E are chronological. Paragraph 5D is what happens when the juvenile first gets there and is essentially found incompetent. So this addresses all juveniles. Suspend. And that's what you have to do in order to have paragraph E.
Right.
So then you get to paragraph E. And it is an additional provision for those juveniles who are likely to become competent within the first year.
Which doesn't apply here.
Right.
So we have nothing to speak to juveniles who do not become competent within the first year.
They're suspended just like all juveniles, and then the court has to order them into, or order somebody to file a petition for either Chapter 51
so
or GIPS.
So you're substituting the civil proceeding for the criminal. You're saying the GIPS supersedes and then we lose, the court loses jurisdiction. There's nothing, there's no precedent for that in the case law, and there's nothing in the statute that allows for that, correct?
Again, I think that just because it uses the word suspend doesn't mean that the court has to infer the authority to go back and reopen the case really at any point other than what's allowed under the statute. So what's allowed under the statute is to restart the case, reexamine, reinitiate the case upon a finding of competence in one of the ordered reports under 5E. So that says, you know, every 3 months we're going to be evaluating this person, 30 days before the end of the order we're going to evaluate this person. And so, yes, I think that's the mechanism for reinitiating the case. But if it's not there, then there is no mechanism for reinitiating.
Counsel, if this young man could have been waived into adult court because he committed the homicide at age 15, correct?
Jurisdictionally, yes.
And the state is arguing that, well, we should consider what you can do with an adult in the same factual circumstances. Why shouldn't we consider that argument, given that he could have been waived into adult court at 15, and then the same determination that was made in juvenile court would be subject to a re-evaluation under the statute?
Well, for one, we don't know for certain whether the state was going to waive into adult court or not. I think there's indication in the record that would go against that. I think that there's kind of argument both ways, but it seems unlikely that this kid would have gone through the adult proceedings, that they would have filed for a waiver. So I think in this specific case, at least, that doesn't necessarily apply. Now, as Your Honor is saying, because jurisdictionally that was allowed, we're making the evaluation now as opposed to then. If we look at the factors for waiver, they essentially get worse with time. The number of times that the word prior and previous is used, I'm looking at section 938.18, and at paragraph 5am, the word prior or previous is used 5 times in the criteria for waiver. So they look at the prior record of the juvenile, whether the court has previously waived its jurisdiction over the juvenile, whether the juvenile is previously convicted following a waiver of the court's jurisdiction, has been previously found delinquent. The passage of time really does nothing but hurt the juvenile's chances of being treated as a juvenile. I was just thinking about this on the drive in. AL is now 21 years old. So at the time this happened, he's 15, he weighs under 100 pounds, he's less than 5 feet tall. And if we're doing this evaluation now, we're looking at a 21-year-old man.
Well, I found it interesting, though no one argues this. You know, we say whether charges can be filed in adult court, of course, we look at the statute to determine whether they can be filed in adult court. And since they could have filed these charges in adult court and you did not, I wonder why you think it would be inequitable to use the adult proceedings for reevaluation, because that's all the state wants to do. They want him reevaluated.
Right. Well, first of all, this, just to avoid confusion, the adult court would not have had original jurisdiction over this, right?
He'd have to be waived, right. I agree. But we have some case law that if you couldn't waive him in, then you have different policies underneath what proceedings you may use, or at least that's the argument that's been made here, because you could waive him in, even though he wasn't waived into adult court. The proceedings for reevaluation in adult court then maybe make more sense, because he could have been there to begin with.
Again, he could have been there to begin with, but if
we
take...
Counsel, can I just clarify something? Can a juvenile who's been found incompetent be waived into adult court?
No, this was initially when the charges were filed. At least that was my question to him.
Not during the period of incompetence, I guess. The case would be suspended. So again, the type of person that this would affect is likely somebody who's young and likely developmentally delayed. Again, AL had a low IQ, has a low IQ, but some more development now that he's 21 years old. And so taking that perspective would essentially allow the state, if it charges somebody who is small, young, developmentally delayed, to essentially wait. And that was one of the reasons that I was getting to earlier that Judge D saw initially in the trial court level. He said, I'm not saying the state's doing anything wrong here, but allowing this allows the state to get essentially a second kick at the cat, he said, for jurisdictional purposes, for waiver. And so just making that assessment 6 years later on a small kid who's developmentally disabled when he's a 21-year-old man, I think does make a big difference. There's also sort of an open question about whether the state has any affirmative duty to ensure that the child is restored to competency. That is one of the purposes of the Juvenile Justice Code.
Right, but if he were reevaluated, and he was restored to competence for these other charges, he's already been convicted and sentenced, correct, for what he did at age 17, so he wasn't incompetent at that date. If he were reevaluated and found to be competent now, the juvenile court wouldn't have any jurisdiction. If they're going to proceed against him, they have to charge him in adult court, don't they?
I think the way that this would work, if the court reinstated, would be the evaluation would still be done under the power of the juvenile court, and if he's found competent, then there would be a waiver hearing where the court would decide whether he would be waived into adult court or the case would be dismissed.
But if that occurred, what criteria would be used in regard to waiver in adult court? Would they be the same or different, or do you just don't know?
Well, it would be the same waiver that is required by the statute. It would just be factually very different, as I said, because he's 6 years older.
But if he's found to be competent, juvenile court can't proceed against him. They've lost their jurisdiction at 21.
Right, but he's been subject to a GIPS order for 2 years. Yeah. He was living out of home. He was getting, medical treatment. He was subject to reports and potential even jail sanctions up to 10 days if he violated some of those conditions. I'm not clear what the court would have done if, for instance, he would have been, found delinquent of this immediately. Again, this was, the facts of the case, this was something that may have been impulsive. He was defending his young brother against an older cousin, and it doesn't seem like a premeditated, egregious act. They may well have done a relatively simple disposition. But a 21-year-old who has since been convicted of a different crime would be unlikely to be treated the same way as the small 15-year-old he was when he was
10. Right. So, okay. Thank you.
Counsel, is there anything in the statutes that would prohibit what you just outlined for the state to do? To come back, have AL reevaluated, and if he is found to be competent, to have the juvenile court decide either to waive him into adult court or dismiss the case. Is there anything in the statutes that would prohibit that?
Section 938.30, sub 5, sub D says that the case shall be suspended when he's found incompetent and doesn't have a mechanism for going forward.
Okay. So I guess what I'm asking is it necessary for the statute to have a mechanism for that? Right. So the case is suspended because he was found to be not competent.
Right.
Right. So now if the court discovers through whatever means, in this case through other proceedings, that he very well may be competent, why can the juvenile court not say, all right, come on back, we're going to evaluate you? Why can't they do that? Why is there no authority in the court to take that step?
Well, the simple answer is because it's not in the statute. Because the court gets its power from the legislature withheld that
power. Let me just stop you there for a little bit. So the court does have some inherent authority, right?
Right.
Okay. So why does the court not have the inherent authority to say, we need to reevaluate you. We have reason to believe that the precondition for suspension no longer exists.
Your Honor, that issue wasn't briefed at this level, so I'm going to speak kind of off the cuff here. But when I did research it at a lower level, because the Court of Appeals didn't reach this, what I remember was that I looked at the types of powers that are usually claimed as inherent powers, and they were very different than this type of power. They were a lot closer to sort of administrative issues than this, which really touches on a jurisdictional issue, because I'm going to go back to Jackson v. Indiana, which...
Yeah, before you do, what jurisdictional issue? This does not seem to be jurisdictional. You can't proceed against a non-competent defendant.
Right.
But that does not oust the court's jurisdiction, does it?
It limits the court's jurisdiction.
In what way does it limit its jurisdiction?
If the court's jurisdiction, which is the jurisdiction is broad, but its power to exercise its jurisdiction, its competency, is given to it by the court, by the statute, then its jurisdiction really ends when the case is suspended and cannot be unsuspended.
I want to explore that just real briefly here.
Sure.
Because I'm not aware of any circumstance in which suspension equates to loss of jurisdiction.
It's probation.
Suspension is the cessation of activity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Temporary. Yes. That does not necessarily equate to loss of jurisdiction. Because if the court lost jurisdiction, then the case would be over. It would be dismissed, not suspended.
Well, again, going back to the probation example, if a court imposes 9 months and stays it for a year, and the year of probation runs, probation's over, the court can't then go back and do anything with those 9 months, even though it simply stayed. At least
okay,
in Black's Law Dictionary, a stay and a suspension are equivalent.
Well, I'm going to differ with Black's Law Dictionary.
Though, it's a second definition. So
yeah, because you know the legislature has used both terms, suspension and stay, and they've used them in different contexts. As you point out, they use stay in the context of sentencing, and they use suspended here. So presumably they had something different in mind when they used a different word, right? That's our natural presumption, yes?
I know. That's yes.
Okay.
Let's look at the words of the legislature and see what they have in mind. Vis-a-vis the comment of inherent authority, I recall the circuit court said, I'm not an inherent authority sort of guy, and I want to look at the words of the statute. I want to also look at the words of the statute with regard to not jurisdiction, sometimes we use that phrase, but competency to exercise the jurisdiction. And that's raised in the second issue that has been advanced here. Does the circuit court retain competency over a juvenile delinquency petition that has been suspended due to the juvenile's incompetence and subsequently converted to a GIPS order and that the order has expired? Give me your statutory language of the legislature argument vis-a-vis the loss of competency because the GIPS order has expired.
Well, again, this is not my primary argument, right, because I'm arguing the statute's unambiguous. That's section one in my brief. Section two, if the court finds the statute's ambiguous based on this reading of the word suspend, I'm at my red light here.
You can answer Justice Bradley's question.
If based on the word suspend, the court believes the court has, if not, you know, inherent authority, simply the authority to reinitiate the proceedings, I still think that the legislature tied the ability to reevaluate the competency to GIPS, because GIPS is the way that you maintain a kind of nexus with the child, right? That you don't say, okay, this child is accused of a homicide, but he's incompetent. He goes off into the world, and hopefully we catch him as soon as possible so he's not an adult when he comes back. The GIPS is how they monitor the child and provide accountability, and so I do believe that it requires, that the statute requires for the GIPS to be ongoing. I think there's something kind of, in a sense, administrative about Judge D's reaction to it. He seemed to be kind of confused about the idea of even, you know, reinitiating this case when he didn't have the GIPS order in front of him. And so I think that just the way that the court works, that makes sense to the trial judge as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Deputy Solicitor General Luke Berg for the state of Wisconsin. May it please the court.
Would you move the mic up a little bit? You're a little bit taller, and that might be helpful. Thank you.
The issue in this case is not a new one. Wisconsin courts have been dealing with incompetency for a very long time. And the rule has always been that when a person is found incompetent, the court will suspend the case indefinitely, and it may reopen the case at any time if the person ever regains competency. That was the rule at common law before any statute covered this topic. It was the rule in the earliest statutory provisions, and it's the rule in the adult provision today. So when the legislature created the juvenile incompetency provision in the 90s, and it borrowed language from the adult provision, including the word suspend, that was a loaded term. The legislature would have assumed that courts had the power to unsuspend because they'd been doing it for 100 years. So it's not surprising that the statute doesn't have an explicit general procedure for reopening suspended proceedings. Now, in addition to that historical point, there are three more textual reasons why you should hold that juvenile courts have the authority to reopen suspended proceedings. Number one, the word suspend itself means to temporarily delay or defer. The obvious implication is that proceedings can resume if the entire reason for the delay goes away. Number two, there's a stark contrast between subsection D and the subsection right above it, subsection C.
Counsel, since the statute doesn't speak to the resumption of delinquency proceedings following a finding of incompetency and not likely to regain, restore, or gain competency, as the case may be, are you suggesting, is your primary argument, that we should look to the common law to fill that gap, if you will, rather than reading something into the statute?
I think the statute itself gives juvenile courts authority to reopen proceedings. I think if the statute said nothing at all, the court would have inherent authority to reopen it on its own, and we know that because courts did that before any statutes even covered this topic. The case that we cited, Crocker, talks about that. But given that that was the pattern of how courts deal with incompetency, when the juvenile provision brought over the adult language, including the word suspend, I think that word suspend itself carried with it the power to reopen suspended proceedings.
Is your primary argument as well that the statute is unambiguous?
That's right, yes. We think it's unambiguous for four reasons. So the word suspend, which I've just been talking about, the second sort of textual reason, just looking at the face of the text, is the contrast between C and D. So C covers the defense of insanity and requires courts to dismiss the proceeding if the juvenile is found not mentally responsible. D, which immediately follows C, is identical, except that it replaces one word, dismiss with suspend. So the legislature must have intended those two to function very differently. And if courts didn't have the authority to reopen suspended proceedings, except for in this narrow circumstance in E, then in a lot of cases, suspend and dismiss would be functionally equivalent. The third textual reason has to do with just the absurdity of it and the general purposes of the Juvenile Justice Code, which is to hold juveniles accountable for crime and to protect the public from future crime. So if, as AL argues, courts lacked the power to reopen proceedings, except in the narrow case where they became competent within a year, then juveniles who commit various serious crimes would evade accountability for those crimes, and the court would have no way to use all of the dispositions available under a juvenile delinquency.
How would you respond to your opposing counsel's argument that accountability is provided via the JIPS order, because under JIPS proceedings, the juvenile court has at its disposal pretty much all of the dispositional alternatives that it would have in delinquency court short of secure detention?
Well, JIPS doesn't have all of the dispositions available, so that's point number one. But point two, the JIPS proceeding is not an adjudication of the act. That has never been adjudicated. It is a handoff to provide services to the juvenile because he's incompetent. But the juvenile delinquency petition still has not been resolved. So this same structure occurs in the adult context. So if a criminal charge is brought and the defendant is incompetent, the criminal case is suspended, and the state may then bring a separate proceeding, a Chapter 51 commitment, and those two are independent. And when the Chapter 51 commitment ends, the state still has the power to reopen the suspended criminal case. This court held that exactly in Deisinger and Porter and Haskins, those cases that we cited from the 70s, and that's the exact issue in the case. The JIPS order is sort of like the Chapter 51 commitment in the adult context. The juvenile delinquency case is sort of like the criminal charge, although juvenile delinquency is not criminal. But the idea is that the GIPS proceeding here is meant to deal with the incompetency and is not resolving the underlying case, which is, in this case, a homicide. The juvenile delinquency code specifically contemplates waiver occurring after a juvenile has turned 17. In the waiver provision, 938 sub 18, it says explicitly that courts retain jurisdiction to waive the case into adult court even after the juvenile turns 18. So I think that this situation is covered by the juvenile delinquency code. Now, AL's argument in this case is that subsection 5E is the exclusive route to reopening suspended proceedings, but he's wrong for three reasons. First, subsection E doesn't say that anywhere in its text. It doesn't say only. It doesn't say courts may not reopen suspended proceedings except as in this subsection or anything like that. So he is reading in a limitation that is simply not there. Second, subsection E is not primarily about how to reopen suspended proceedings. The primary command or mandate in subsection E is requiring juvenile courts to conduct these periodic reevaluations for juveniles who are likely to become competent in the near future. The language about resuming the proceedings is sort of buried at the bottom of subsection 2 of sub E, and so that's a very odd way to create an exclusive route to reopening if that's what the legislature intended. So a way to think about it, the way I've been thinking about it, is E basically says if a juvenile is likely to become competent, courts must conduct these periodic reevaluations, whereas if a juvenile is unlikely to be competent, the court may but need not and can if the circumstances warrant it.
Let's take a look at that language and show me where you get the may and must from.
Subsection E.
Just a moment.
What?
I have to catch up with my question and get the statute in front of me. You may proceed.
So subsection E1 says a juvenile who is not competent to proceed but who is likely to become competent shall be periodically reexamined with written reports of those reexamines every 3 months. And then it sets forth what those reports shall indicate. And then 2 talks about the copies of the report being transmitted to the district attorney. So it's setting forth a process for this mandatory periodic reevaluation. And only at the very end of sub 2 does it say, oh, and by the way, if one of these reports suggests that the juvenile is competent, the court can resume the delinquency proceeding. So that does not suggest at all that this is the exclusive route to reopening proceedings.
Your opposing counsel, as I recall, argues that the statute limits the reexamination only to situations where GIPS order is still effective, and here, of course, it was terminated, or there is commitment, if I recall correctly. Those words come right out of the statute. How do you circumvent those words?
So I have three answers to that second argument. So first, as a textual matter, the text does not say anywhere that the court loses jurisdiction over the juvenile delinquency case if the GIPS petitions ends. So that's the textual response. As a formal matter, the juvenile delinquency case and the GIPS case are separate cases. They have separate case numbers, separate dockets, separate filings. So there is no reason formally to think that they should be jurisdictionally interrelated.
Let me ask with regard to that. When the GIPS order was entered, I understand that GIPS then is, under case law, exclusive original jurisdiction. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And what that means is that the court has exclusive jurisdiction over the facts that supported the GIPS order. So typically what that means is if a crime is committed by somebody under 10 years old, the GIPS court has exclusive jurisdiction over that. It couldn't be brought as a delinquency case, and it couldn't be brought in adult court. Here, the facts supporting the GIPS order is the incompetency. The fact supporting the delinquency case, on the other hand, is the homicide. So they're two separate cases. The court certainly, the GIPS court certainly has exclusive jurisdiction over the GIPS case, but the juvenile delinquency court still has jurisdiction over the delinquency case. So the third response I was going to give to your question is that this exact issue has been addressed by this court in the adult context. This exact argument has been rejected. So the same dual structure occurs in the adult court. As I said before, you'll have a criminal charge which gets suspended, and then the state may file a civil commitment, Chapter 51. So in Porter, the case from 1977, a defendant had been subject to a civil commitment. The criminal case was paused, and then he was released from the civil commitment. And his argument was, now that I've been released from civil commitment, the court loses jurisdiction to reopen the criminal case. And this court said, no, that's not right. The criminal case is its own independent case. They're not jurisdictionally related. And the only limit on reopening the criminal case is the right to a speedy trial, and you have to bring a separate motion for that. And that hasn't been brought here. So for all three of those reasons, the second argument, I think, fails.
Counsel, subsection E provides for reexamination every 3 months. If a court in between those examinations, let's say one examination was conducted at 3 months, the next one due 3 months after that, the six-month mark, let's say at 4 months, the court becomes aware of information suggesting that the juvenile has regained competency. Could the court immediately order a reevaluation at that point, or must it wait for the six-month mark?
Absolutely. I think it could order a reevaluation immediately.
Okay. And that's because E is setting out minimum requirements for periodic evaluation. It is
right.
Not supplanting the court's authority to order a reevaluation. Is that correct?
That's exactly right.
Okay. Yep.
I also want to just talk a little bit about E, because I think it's helpful to understand the history of where E came from, to understand what E is designed to be doing. So E, the language in E, was copied directly from the language of the adult provision. The adult provision contains this analogous procedure of periodic reexamination. Those provisions in the adult incompetency statute were enacted to codify certain holdings from this court that applied limits on confinement in Haskins and Deisinger and Porter. Those very cases explained that the confinement-related issues are distinct from the ability of a court to allow the criminal case to pend and to reopen it at any time. And those cases held that there is no limit on a court's authority to reopen a suspended case, even if the person has been released. So if those cases don't limit a court's authority to reopen proceedings, then neither do the adult provisions, which codify those holdings, and in turn, neither do the juvenile provisions, which borrow directly from the adult provisions. Now, you can draw these inferences just by looking at the text and the holdings of these cases. But in this case, we have much better. We have legislative history that makes abundantly clear that 5E was not designed to be the exclusive route to reopening proceedings. The drafting attorney explained that he was drawing directly from the adult provisions and that he drafted them in order to comply with these cases which held that courts have ongoing authority to reopen suspended proceedings. He also explained very clearly in the legislative history that the word suspend was chosen specifically just in case the juvenile later regains competence. The original draft required the court to dismiss the case if the juvenile was found unlikely to regain competence. And the Milwaukee DA's office and the judge commented and said, we need to replace dismiss with suspend because otherwise we would lose jurisdiction to waive into adult court if the child ever regained competency. That's the exact issue in this case.
How do you address the argument that juveniles are different? That, yes, we want them to be accountable, but they also age out. They also, as described by opposing counsel, were potentially young and all of these things. And the situation also in the opposing brief of maybe you have a 50-year-old or a 60-year-old that you're now going to reach back and reopen this juvenile proceeding. So how do you reconcile treating juveniles differently with the mechanisms of treatment and addressing age with this potential of reaching back 50 years?
Well, I would say I think the juvenile code specifically considers this situation. It considers cases where the case has not been resolved before the juvenile became an adult, and it says that courts retain jurisdiction to waive it into adult court. So that's been specifically addressed by the juvenile code. Now, if this court is concerned about the hypotheticals of a 50-year-old or something, there's a lot of protections against that. So
like
AL could file a motion asserting his speedy trial rights, saying it violates my right to a speedy trial or my rights to due process to have this case hanging over my head for a number of years. But that's a separate issue from the one in this case and has to be brought in a separate motion. AL hasn't argued that. It's only been 3 or 4 years. It hasn't been 50 years. And the other point I will make is that the waiver determination still has to be made by the court. So it could be that the AL would be reevaluated, found competent, and then the circuit court will decide not to waive it into adult court because it thinks, for whatever reason, it's not appropriate. But that's a separate issue that will be decided in the future of this case and is not at issue now. And part of the reason it's important to sort of not base your decision on those hypotheticals is it's not hard to imagine a situation where a juvenile is still a juvenile when he regains competency. So imagine a 13-year-old committing a crime, a serious crime like a homicide, being incompetent for a little over a year, and then regaining competency at 14. The state would want to reopen that proceeding just to proceed in the juvenile delinquency code and would still have 4 years to apply a lot of the dispositions under the juvenile code. So if this court held that there's no ability to reopen after a year, that case would not even be allowed to proceed in the juvenile context.
What exactly do you want this court to hold?
We want you to hold that courts have the authority to reopen a suspended proceeding at any time if there is reason to believe that the juvenile has regained competency. That's the only issue in this case.
Well, not every suspended hearing. Isn't it only in this juvenile situation?
Yes.
I mean,
for
your statement is so broad.
For juvenile cases, if a juvenile delinquency case has been suspended due to incompetency, hold that the court has the power to reopen the suspended proceeding.
When?
At any time that there's reason to believe the juvenile has regained competency.
When the juvenile is 22?
Yes. Even as an adult, the court has the power to reopen it. Once it's reopened, the court can do a limited number of things. It can either waive it into adult court, or it can dismiss the case if it declines to waive. But the case can be reopened at any time so that the underlying crime, which has yet to be adjudicated, can be adjudicated.
Why shouldn't your opposing counsel says, in an alternative argument, I guess, essentially, look, there's something missing here. And shouldn't the legislature be addressing this vacuum rather than we superimposing the adult procedure onto the juvenile procedure when it's not set forth in the actual text of the statute? Can you respond to that, please?
Well, I think the text does suggest, I think the best reading of the text is that the court has the power to reopen. I think the word suspend itself typically means a temporary delay and suggests that courts can reopen. But even if there wasn't that suggestion from the text, we know from the way this court has dealt with this situation in the adult context that courts have this inherent authority to suspend and reopen cases to deal with situations of incompetency when they come up.
Courts have inherent authority, but of course inherent authority is to be sparingly exercised. If we want, we have inherent authority to fill in any gap left by the legislature, arguably. But perhaps that's not wise for us to do, to superimpose writing legislation for the legislature. I hear you making that argument in other cases. And yet here we're supposed to import an adult procedure. And of course, there's a reason that there's a difference between adult courts and juvenile court, because they're so supposed to be handled differently. But you want us to reach out and import an adult procedure into juvenile court because it's not there in the text.
I want to be very clear. I'm not asking you to rely on inherent authority. My point was simply that you could, that courts have this authority. But I think in this case, the text of the statute, the best reading of the statute, is that courts have that authority as a matter of text, as a matter of statutory authority, because of the word suspend itself, because of the contrast between dismiss and suspend, because of the historical context in which the juvenile competency provision was enacted.
Well, when you get to historical context, then you get to, by definition, I think, you're saying the language is ambiguous. What does suspend mean? Let's take a look at the historical context and find out.
Well, no, actually, I think historical context, as I'm talking about it right now, is part of the intrinsic analysis, the textual analysis. This court has to interpret words as they were understood at the time that they were enacted.
And where in Kalal do you find that?
Kalal talks about the context being a relevant part of the intrinsic analysis, the statutory context.
The statutory context, not the historical context.
And in later cases, this court has said that the relevant history of a statute, the way the language of the statute has changed over time, is part of that intrinsic analysis. So
that's statutory analysis.
Yes, right. That's right. So we're relying on that, the way that the adult provisions have changed over time, the similarity in the language of the juvenile provision to the adult provision, and the holdings of cases which clearly show what the juvenile code provision was designed to address. I think all of that is part of the intrinsic analysis. But even if you think that the statute is ambiguous, even if you don't buy that argument, then Kalal says you turn to the legislative history, and the legislative history answers the question in this case. So unless you think the statute is unambiguous in the other direction, the state has to win because the legislative history clearly addresses the issue here. If there are no further questions, I will sit down. Thank you.
Counsel, as I recall, in your brief, you go into a lot of legislative history. Is your legislative history clearly supporting the position of the state?
In my brief, the reason I mentioned the legislative history to begin with was because the Court of Appeals relied on it, and I felt like I had to address it to some extent. I'm extremely cautious about it for a number of reasons. For one, probably the strongest piece of evidence that the Court of Appeals cited is essentially a hand-scribbled piece of paper. It does have a date, and it says Judge Flanagan's name. Looks like it might be the handwriting of the LRB drafting person. I don't know who in Congress saw that. You know, trying to discern the specific intent of the legislature is complicated enough. We don't know who put these documents in there. There's all sorts of problems. But the Court of Appeals relied on it. I do think it's interesting. It shows the genesis of the law. It shows what the request was from Judge Flanagan and what they were looking to do. And I think that it shows a willingness to address the concerns of juveniles immediately. And I think that it also shows a very different way of addressing juveniles as opposed to adults. Because with the NGIs, for instance, they're, you know, find it, dismiss the case, and do a gyps. And they want a gyps over here as well. There's a few things that I want to get to. First off, I'm looking at the adult competency statute, which says, looking specifically at subsection 6A, if the court determines it's unlikely the defendant will become competent within the remaining commitment period, it shall discharge the defendant from the commitment and release him or her, except as provided in paragraph B. It goes on to talk about chapter 51. Then it says, the court may order the defendant to appear in court at specified intervals for redetermination of his or her competency to proceed. So for the adult statute, it gives the court that power, the power to do the recall, the reexamination, the redetermination into the future. That's what's limited by, you know, speedy trial challenges, if the case may, whatever the case may be. But that type of language is not in the juvenile statute, and I have to assume that that's intentional, and that it's because of the difference between juveniles and adults. It's in order to address the aging out problem, which I discussed in my brief. Secondly, with regard to potentially dangerous juveniles, there is a priority in the juvenile incompetence statute to Chapter 51. It says if the court finds that the elements of Chapter 51 would be met, the court should order the state to petition for a Chapter 51. And that is because it requires a finding that the person is a danger to themselves or to others. Chapter 51 is a lot more involved than the JIPS. And so if the concern is public safety, the concern is maintained by prioritizing Chapter 51. Again, I think accountability is present in the JIPS statute, and as far as adjudicating the dispute, finding fault, I think that that is probably something that ends up to some extent being sacrificed in order to get treatment, to get safety, to get accountability of JIPS, because as I said, the complicated problem that will not go away is that some juveniles will be incompetent, and do we prosecute them now and do what we usually know as a prosecution to the full extent of the law? Do we wait until they become adults and create a class of juveniles who were incompetent when this happened and only treat them as adults? That seems to me very inequitable. And I think that it is, to an extent, a trade-off, but a trade-off that's made by the legislature and supported by the legislative language. I think the state mentioned as well that the statutes use the word suspend sometimes and dismiss at other times, and they would be effectively interchangeable. If you comb through the statutes, pretty much every time they use suspend, they're going to say for how long or subject to what condition. They're going to say suspended for up to 60 days, suspended for up to 6 months. It doesn't just say suspend and leave it open.
So, counsel, are you conceding that the practical effect, given your reading of D, is that suspend functionally would mean dismiss?
Well, again, suspend addresses all incompetent juveniles. So in that it treats all of them the same, but some don't end up getting reinstated, then yes, for that subcategory it would mean dismissed. But chronologically it happens before, so it doesn't get to that specifically. It addresses that by not including language such as the adult statute contains, that in perpetuity the court can revisit this issue as much as it wants. The red light is on.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you
very much for a very interesting case. We are going to take a brief recess so that these students can go on to another venue and some other students can join us. And then we will be back for our second case of the day. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.